You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, being the second Wednesday of the month, it's time for the people from Hutchison Legal to come in and give us some answers to some questions and send them away with another couple of questions. So it's really great. We've got Andrew and Annabelle with us. Afternoon.
Hi, Alan. How's it going?
I'm going really well.
That's good.
And I know Andrew's been in before, and Annabelle, I think you might have been once before anyway.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right. So we had a question about the changes of bail, and I know that somebody asked the question, and I noticed that we've got to be a little bit careful because I think there's a case at the moment in the courts, because I heard something about it last night, where the changes of bail, and I do believe the new Premier might have put it off for a while, but prior to that, there was that you couldn't charge a person under about 14, I'm not sure whether it was four, even the 14s, you couldn't charge an offence, but some of these cases are almost like an attempted murder or something like that. People are starting to get a bit concerned. Can they still be charged if these laws come in? Or if a 12-year-old arguably committed murder, what happens?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's very important for us to unpack it as well. I think the main legislation change really came in, I guess the first one really came in 2018 when, you know, the legislation decided to tighten rules around bail. And now that's why it's in the courts for us to, you know, pass on whether or not that there should be a reform, you know, the bail reform. But as to your question about, you know, sort of young children or children between the ages of 10 to 14, I guess currently in Victoria, it's interesting to note that the age of criminal liability is actually 10. Yep. So it's a lot younger than 14. There is the move of moving it to, I think, 12 and then 14 later down the track. Sort of the idea is that children of that age may lack capacity or to understand the seriousness of their offence. It's obviously up to the prosecution to show that they understood their actions as well. So, you know, the onus is not on the kids to prove that they didn't really know what's happening, but sort of really on the prosecution to prove that the children knew what they were doing and that they knew that their behaviour was probably going to cause serious harm to whoever they were doing it to.
But that's only when it gets to court, doesn't it? So can the police still, under the new legislations, can they charge an 11 or a 12-year-old if they were involved in something like murder, or would the legislation say they can't be charged?
Look, I think the legislation, it's still in debate at this point in time, so no one's safe to say, you know, what it's going to end up being. But the idea is that, you know, children are, they can be, I guess the big question of it is really, you know, who should be liable when they make such an actions? You know, would it be the parents of these kids or would it be the kids themselves? And I think there is, you know, some sort of debate as well, you know, with children, say, 10. You know, do they really understand what they're doing? Is it a lot to do with their upbringing? Is it a lot to do with the fact, are their parents teaching them the right things? You know, these are questions of sort of...
The parents are never going to be called into court, though, are they? Under the rules now, parents don't get charged.
Yeah, I guess under the rules now they don't. But look, it's a possibility that, you know, that they can. I think we've been we have been looking at that as well. And I think Andrew might have something to add.
Yep. Oh, yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, it's interesting in Australia, yeah, at the moment there's nothing that holds parents accountable. But there's an interesting case in America at the moment where parents have been charged with manslaughter because they let their kid have access to a gun and he had serious issues and he killed some people. So in America, there's certainly precedent for parents being charged, but at the moment, not in Australia.
Yeah. But I guess we still have walked around this a little bit. If this new legislation comes in, will the police be able to charge children under 14 if it's a serious offence?
Yeah, at the moment they can be charged if it can be proven that they understood the seriousness of what they were doing, but the new legislation will phase that out. So it'll go to 12, under 12 then they can't be charged at all, and then 14. So once that new legislation comes in, a child under 14 cannot be charged with
that at all. So it wouldn't matter how horrific the crime was, it's just straight out, well, they don't understand, so they can't be charged.
That's right, yeah, that's the proposed new law, yep.
All right, look, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And hello to Grant, if you happen to be listening. All right, so we've talked about bail and we've moving on. I understood that with pairing arrangements, I thought it was the Howard government, but I could be quite wrong, and I don't want to get into politics anyway, that it was started off that it was equal parenting rights. But it's changing, is it, or has it already changed?
Yeah, no, that's right, Alan. It's the changes are in motion and probably won't be too long before that becomes the law, that they're dialing back a bit of what was brought in with that whole equal rights situation. So, yeah, it's quite interesting, the changes to the law that are being proposed. Part of the... what was brought in back then was that the starting point was that mum and dad both have equal right to make decisions,
yep.
and that the court would have to consider equal care as the first port of call, and then only not do equal care when that wasn't in the best interest of the children.
Why have they changed it, do you know?
Yeah, the main reason is because the current law is very confusing to people. So there's lots of people that have the misunderstanding that there's an equal right to have, you know, equal care to the children. So lots, particularly dads, have the view that, well, the law says I get 50-50, so that's what it is, when in reality it's not quite as easy as that.
Is it?
No. So the current law does say that, yeah, technically the starting point is 50-50, but it's most cases the court ultimately decides that that's not actually best for the children. And so what the new law aims to do is to take away that confusion, and the starting point is always, well, what's best for the children in this particular family. Now, that may be equal care in some cases, but more often than not, it tends to be that equal care is not best for a variety of reasons. So the
because of the parents are warring, or why?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So certainly if parents are at war, then equal care is not good for the kids when they get caught up in that. Yep. But the social studies tell us that sometimes equal care is not best for children. So, for example, very young children, the social science tells us that it's best for them to be with the primary attachment figure for most of the time, and to only be away from the primary carer for initially a small and frequent periods of time. So it may progress to equal time once the kids are a bit older, but the studies show that children develop, you know, their development is affected negatively if they're away from the primary carer, which biologically is almost always mum. It's not always, but most of the time it's mum. And so the children suffer, and they'll have a negative impact later on in life if they're deprived of that attachment in the early stages of their life.
So what would you say, because I've heard this said before, that dads, some of the dads really feel as though they've missed out altogether?
Yeah, so I guess the proposal here is to change the misunderstanding. So the outcomes won't necessarily be any different, but I guess for those dads that feel hard done by, it's about understanding that the law looks at not what's best for the parents. So parents don't actually have the rights. Parents have the obligations and the responsibilities, yep. and the arrangement for the kids should be based on what's best for them. So it's all about what's best for the kids, not what's best for mum or dad. And it just so happens that a lot of the time it's not best for the kids to have that equal arrangement. And so it's not about dad's missing out. It's more about, you know, whether kids are missing out or kids are getting the best arrangement.
So what happens? Little Junior gets something really wrong with them. Now, under the other arrangement, it was equal rights between mum and dad, wasn't it? So yeah. Does that mean, well, and I don't want to take sides here, but we'll say mum gets, as you said, that happens more often than not. So mum gets control of the child. The child gets sick. She wants to do A and dad wants to do B. So where does that, like, who's got the major say there? Is it the mum because she's got the child the most, or what?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Alan. And under the current law, the presumption would be that mum and dad, irrespective of where the kids are living, that it's mum and dad have to agree on those major decisions. Yeah. Under the new law, the starting point will be that the court's got to work out what is best. And I think most of the time it will be that mum and dad still should make those decisions together, because that generally is best for children. But there will certainly be times where the court says, if there's high conflict between the parents, you know, it's no good the child being not getting the medical attention they need because mum and dad can't sort it out.
All right, so you talk about the courts. Something happens at 11, 12 o'clock at night. Dad says this has got to happen because the child is critically ill. Mum says no, and there's no time to go to court. So what happens in a case like that? Is it presumption that mum, because the child lives with mum, that she should have the say? Or, I mean, we talk about going to court, but at midnight, 2 a.m, you're not going to find a magistrate.
No, that's right, or a lawyer. I certainly don't answer calls at that time. But no, it's a really good question. I think in reality it comes down to where the kid is on that night. If the parents are separated, if the kid's with dad and there's an emergency, then dad's the one that's going to take the kid to the hospital and make the decisions. And most of the time there is that presumption that both parents have to communicate and agree. But in an emergency, you've just got to do what needs to be done. It becomes an issue where there's a non-emergency situation, like an argument about a vaccine, for example, or some sort of non...
And that happened a bit, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there were some parents that were dead against it and some that were in favour of it. And the courts tended to... When the parents couldn't agree, the courts, more often than not, unless the kid had some pre-existing medical condition that... contraindicated the benefit of the vaccine. Most of the time, the courts followed the prevailing medical opinion and ordered children to be vaccinated.
Did they?
Yes, yeah.
All right, got to take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Same old chords, you would complain that I was never around, and we shouldn't hope. No, we shouldn't hope. If love is so easy, then why am I stuck? If life is so smooth, why can't I get enough? Oh, I'm still lost and running, I can't get enough. No, I'm still lost and running.
Listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Grant. We're talking to both Andrew and Annabelle from Hutchison Legal, our resident people. They come in every second Wednesday of the month between 1 and 2. Now, we've been talking about parenting and the change on the law of that, but also, the other thing that comes up from time to time is child support. So, obviously, this is set by the courts. How do they come up with how is it calculated to start with? And what about you know, if we've just talked about an emergency where a child gets sick and that, how do they decide who pays what share of the medical expense?
Thanks, Alan. I guess the presumption that child support is there and is available and parents should pay child support really applies. People have to pay the minimum amount. It's usually calculated by the child support agency, so they thankfully have a really good formula available. But what they do is they really take into account things like the incomes of the parents. They take into account things like you know, how many nights a fortnight or how many nights in a year the kids have with said parent, and then they do the math and get up and come up with a formula and a dollar figure to pay. But definitely coming back to your question of, you know, say if we had major medical expenses, you know, if the kid unfortunately went to hospital or something like that, who's going to pay? You can always apply, or the parent can always apply to reassess the child support payable if there are special circumstances. One of them can be, you know, if the parties both agree to send the kids to private school. That can be sort of an assessment as well on its own.
Now, before we go on, I thought that might come up because I was going to ask you that. All right, so we've got, I don't want to take sides. The husband or wife says government school's enough and that's all I'm going to pay towards the maintenance. I'm happy to pay that, but I'm going to pay for a public school. Wifey says, or other way around, says, nah, has to be private school. So can the other parent be made to pay the extra, or would the child support be based on the government school and therefore the other parent has to make up the difference?
That's a really good question, and unfortunately we see that quite often as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you have differences in schools. I think the understanding is really, you know, what the parents think are in the best interest of the kids, and you know, coming back to what we talked about previously as well, schooling is an issue that parties should sort of hopefully settle on. But I guess
But I'm saying,
yeah,
I'm going to say we can't. This one wants government, this one wants private. There's a huge difference of probably $20,000 a year. And this person says, I'm not going to pay an extra part of a $20,000 when X is good enough.
Look, if one party can afford to pay and wants to push that across, that's something that definitely the parents can, you know, agree upon. But if both parties are, you know, unable to afford it, then, you know, the understanding is that, you know, you... public school is what it is.
All right, so that's if they can afford it. What about the person who can afford it? Like, we'll say both can, but one says, I am not going to pay extra. I'm only going to pay for government school. What happens then?
Yeah, the starting point, Alan, is that if there's no agreement to send the kids to a private school, then the other parent's not liable to contribute to those costs. It depends on what was... If they both agreed to send the kids to a private school before they separated, then they're both stuck with that. So then, if post-separation, one of them says, well, I'm not going to pay for this anymore, well, the other parent can apply to have the child support reassessed and the other parent will be assessed to contribute to the private fees.
Right.
But if they never agreed to send the kids to a private school and one parent wants to, then the other parent's not liable to contribute to that. But usually the way we negotiate those things is one parent will say, well, I'll agree to your school if you pay for it. And so usually they come to some sort of agreement, but if they can't agree, then, yeah, they're not liable if that was the case.
So the courts can't say the other person, well, you'll have to pay the extra for the private school.
Well, most of the time that's the case. Yeah, there's always exceptions. Like if there was some particular need that the kid had to go to a special school, for example, then the court might say, well, that's fair enough. But, yeah, in the ordinary course of events, if one parent wants a private school, then they've got to pay for it.
Well, that seems fair, doesn't it, really?
Yep.
How do they assess the income of the parents and how do they make sure they've been told the truth?
I guess the easiest way would always be, you know, basing on, you know, your pay slips, your tax returns, so on and so forth. But definitely...
But I own a business.
Yes. So, look, Centrelink or Services Australia, they have great powers available for them as well to, you know, get all of this information available. It's always good to, and it's always recommended, and you should, you know, be frank with them about how much your income is. That's definitely
but
the advice.
When you say Centrelink, though, But say I owned a business, Centrelink have got nothing to do with me, have they? We're the Centrelink.
Yes, yeah, no, that's a good one. So I guess the one available means would be, you know, someone can put in a request to child support to reassess this, and you know, if a party has reasonable means to say that how is XYZ, you know, able to afford specific items, Centrelink can look into it, or child support can look into it.
All right, so who makes the, Andrew, I know you've done a lot of work on this, who makes the decision? Is it the family court, or you keep talking about child support? Is that a different group altogether?
Yeah, that's right. So child support is administered through the Child Support Agency, which comes under the Services Australia umbrella. So
do they have the same powers of a court?
Yeah, they've got very significant powers. The court doesn't sort of... When people go to court, it's up to the parties to argue their cases. So one party would have to try and get, you know, financial statements and try and prove the case. Yep. The judge won't go to the trouble of trying to work it out. But child support... No. So
a judge wouldn't... Say Joe Blow runs his own business, so the judge is not going to subpoena his books and all that sort of stuff.
No. So in Australia, we have an adversarial system where it's up to the parties to run their cases. Other countries do have more what they call an inquisitorial system, where the judge does become the investigator and ask the questions and issue subpoenas. In Australia, it's up to the parties. The parties can issue subpoenas and get, you know, bank statements and things like that. But child support's generally not administered through the courts. It's done through the Child Support Agency, and the Child Support Registrar under the legislation has tremendous power. So they can and they will, you know, get access to bank statements. They'll monitor spending. You know, someone might not be earning anything as far as the tax office is concerned, but they drive a Porsche, they eat out every night. You know, every second weekend they're away overseas on a holiday. The Child Support Agency can deem their income to be at a higher level based on the way they're living.
All right, so who or what is a child support agency? Is it a government body?
It is, yeah, exactly
is
right.
Is it attached to a court, or it's its own body?
No, it's its own body, yeah. And then there is an appeals process. So most things are dealt with by it's a department, a Commonwealth government department. Right. They administer it. If people aren't happy, they can appeal to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. And then if they're not happy with that, you know, sometimes they can bring it to the court. And if it goes to court, then a judge can make a decision, and the judge can make an order about what the income should be deemed, but it would be up to the parties then to come up with the evidence to make the case.
All right, so I've thankfully never had any dealings with it. So as a child support agency, is that run right up the top by judges, or is it run by government?
Yeah, civil servants, yeah. It's like Centrelink. Very much like Centrelink. There's government employees that administer it. They've got pretty complicated formulas they use, and it's only when people disagree. So most of the time that covers it, but if there's a disagreement, it can then be dealt with by a tribunal member or by a judge.
All right, we've just got to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more.
Somehow it seems my thoughts ever
to Lawyers Crepes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, and we're talking in during our legal hour with Hutchinson Legal. Right, well, we've got a question for you to take away next time, and we'd like you to come back with it. I know your first answer is going to say you should take care, but the person wants to know a bit more about this, and we talk about scams. We've been talking about scams in a couple of other shows I've done, not necessarily on the legal side of it, but we've had a two or three people over a period of time ring up and want to know what they can legally do if they get caught in a scam. Well, first of all, how can they legally find out that it's a scam? Is there any legal way they can find out? Secondly, what they can do if they know they've been scammed. Now, I'd suspect if they've been scammed that the money goes in the bank, probably 10 minutes later it's overseas and that account's been closed and you can't get it back. But they want to know, are there legal recourse? And very much how they can legally try and protect themselves. Now, I know that I think Grant told me of a story on air one day where somebody had been sent, not through your company, I must add, where somebody had been sent a thing to finalise a settlement of a house for, you know, a few $100,000 and wasn't there, it was scammed, it was gone. So I guess the first thing we've got to say is you've got to be careful. And if you get some of those, first of all, you need to go and make sure that it is legal, that it is the person you think you're talking to. So I guess if it was coming from a lawyer or someone, you need to ring them up and ask them. But they just want to know what they can do, because they're getting worse and worse, these scams, and they seem to be getting a bit more sophisticated as well. So if you could have a look at that, come back and tell us what they can do legally and if there's any legal recourse. And maybe if you could also look at, I think if the scam, if you pay for it with your credit card, I think the banks might be able to get you some money back or so. If you could have a look at that for us, please. Righto, so let's move on. We're talking all about child support and that. So there's other things other than child support, is there?
Yeah, that's right, Alan. Yeah, a lot of people don't realise, but there's child support deals with the expenses for children, but sometimes the parties themselves have expenses and have a need for financial support. So there's a thing called spousal maintenance, which applies when the parties separate. If one of them has a need for financial support and the other one's got the means to pay it, then they can apply for spousal maintenance for a period of time. Doesn't go on forever, but maybe...
Does it go to a certain age?
It depends on the situation. So usually it's most commonly done for, for a period of time after separation. Sometimes we see it for 1 or 2 years to allow the other party to get back into the workforce and start to stand on their own feet. If the children are, you know, preschool age, sometimes the spousal maintenance will be ordered to continue until the kids get to school so that the other parent can then, you know, do a bit of work. But it does depend on the situation.
All right. What say mum and dad split? Dad pays support because mum's really can't afford to keep the child or whatever, so they're paying that. And all of a sudden, mum remarries, so she's now got a separate income. Does dad still expected to pay support for those young children?
Yeah, no. If mum remarries, then that ends the former partner's obligation to pay. So, yeah, as soon as she remarries, she's given up her financial support, and her new husband will have to work it out together.
All right. So, what if they move in together?
Yeah, so the court can, it's not as easy in a de facto relationship because it becomes hard, you know, sometimes hard to, you know, marriage is easy to prove, you get the marriage certificate and it's pretty obvious. In a de facto scenario, the former partner can always apply to the court and have the spousal maintenance reassessed on the basis that mum's now repartnered, she's got someone who can financially contribute. And the thing with spousal maintenance is that it's always up for review. So if anyone's circumstances change, you can bring it back to court to have it reassessed.
Now, I'm going to throw a question at you. All right. So mum's... And I'm not having a go at mum's here. I mean, it goes both
ways.
Right. So I don't want to be accused of that. But I guess... All right. So they split and they're both living separately. One... Well, we'll say mum because that's very often the way it can happen. So she gets another partner, but what clarifies as a relationship? Do they have to live with them 7 days a week? Supposing mum had somebody move in 2-3 nights a week. Does that become a de facto relationship or not? Yeah. I can tell by the look in your face you wish I'd
asked
that.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Ellen. It's one of these grey areas where every case depends on its circumstances. It would be, if there was often it's clear cut, if someone started a new relationship, it's pretty obvious. But when there's a dispute about it, then the court has to, if it ends up in court, the judge looks at a whole host of factors. One of them is if they're physically living together. Yep. The test is, are they living together on a quote-unquote genuine domestic basis? So they don't, by definition, they don't have to be living together. Some people are in a de facto relationship. They might live interstate or overseas. Most of the time they live together, so that's the most obvious factor. But it is only one factor. So, if mum's new partner's sort of at the home 2 or 3 nights a week, the other factors are, what's the press release? Has mum told all her family and friends that this is her partner, or has she kept it pretty quiet? Does he provide financial support to her? Things like that. What's the public image? Do they go out and socialise together? They might not live together, but they might go out together all the time and socialise as a couple, attend events. So there's a whole lot of different things. And these cases are the ones where sometimes you need almost the private investigator. You need the photos of them at the restaurant, and you need the aeroplane tickets and bank statements and things like that to try and make the case. But yeah.
All right. So, what about, I see here that there's, you've got two things here I want to cover fairly quickly. What's an adult child maintenance? Why would you be having one partner have to be paying for an adult child?
Yeah, so adult child maintenance is not all that common these days anymore, but that applies where, so child support that we talked about earlier covers children until they turn 18, or to the end of the school year that they turn 18 in. Sometimes if a child's still at home and is being supported by one of the parents, if they're studying, that's the most common scenario. The kid's gone to university, can't support him or herself, and the other parent can apply for ongoing maintenance. So it's not as easy as child support. There's no adult child support agency. It's got to be done through the courts or negotiated. But similarly, if one parent's got a really high income and can support the other parent with that child, then it can be ordered. These days, though, if the kid's working a part-time job, which most of them do, then that sort of kills the argument for adult child maintenance. The other scenario would be if an adult child's got a disability and is relying on, dependent on the other parent.
All right, look, I'll take a quick break. I've got another couple of real good questions I want to ask you before you go.
Speak to the sky when all the things go wrong, and you'll know you're not talking to the air. To the air. And the world will look better from up there. Down, and you'll know when you're talking to the
listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to our Legal Hour again. Right, there's a couple of things that I just need to run through fairly quickly. The first one is I see that there can be child support for a stepchild. What? How can that come about? Why wouldn't the original parent be eligible for the maintenance rather than the stepchild?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question because the legal point of view is that the kids need to be looked after and it's up to the adults to work that out. Now, where the biological parents are still on the scene, then they're the ones that are liable financially. So right. Child support would be between the biological parents. But where stepchild maintenance comes in is if the biological parent is no longer around. So sometimes, you know, mum will have the baby, dad won't be around, never involved, doesn't sometimes even know that the kid's been born.
Yeah, doesn't want to. Yep.
And then the sad thing is then that mum repartners, the new partner becomes effectively the father figure for the child, contributes financially, supports the child. From a legal point of view, if they separate, it's better that he pays for the kid than the kid misses out. So stepchild maintenance can, where someone's effectively taken the role of the biological, usually father, just because of the way that yep. nature works, but they can then be hit with having to provide financial support for that child.
It wouldn't be the same, say the lady had the baby, but the man and wife are still together, gets to about 3 or 4 years of age and then they separate, so and she gets another partner fairly quickly, so that person's been with the child for 10, 12, 14 years, dad's still on the scene there somewhere. So the stepfather wouldn't be eligible in that, would they?
No, that's right. That they wouldn't have to contribute. And in fact, it goes the other way, that if they separate, the stepfather gets extra credit in dividing the assets for the fact that he's helped provide for a child that wasn't his.
Right. Yeah. Couple of other quick things. Mum and dad separate, got a couple of children, and dad wants to go interstate for work. Or mum wants to go into state work. She's got she's got the custody of the child. They're a terrible way to frame it. She's got custody of the child and she wants to go into state. She's met a new partner or she wants to work in state. Dad says, well, no, I'm paying and I want to see my child. How do you sort that out?
Yeah, it's really tricky. Relocation cases, as we call them, are some of the most tricky ones to sort out because there's no middle ground. Either one parent goes and it kills the relationship with the other one, or certainly makes it harder. The courts generally, as a general rule, don't stop parents. You know, parents are free to do what they want. So if mum or dad wants to relocate, they can. But the question becomes then, if they're going to move interstate, then what's best for the children? And then it becomes a matter of assessing that, you know, sometimes one parent will relocate. Say, for example, they've been in a domestic violence situation. Mum's been isolated from her family and friends. She wants to relocate interstate to be with her family, get a job, get some support. Dad's been violent. The courts will probably say, well, yeah, it is best for the kids to be able to go with mum.
Yep.
If it's the other way around, you know, kids have always been here, all their family and support networks are here, the school's here, the kids are a bit older, they don't want to move, one parent wants to relocate, well, in that scenario, it may be harder for that parent to be able to get the kids to go. They might be limited to, you know, half the school holidays and stuff like that.
All right, quickly, we're running out of time. Out of all the cases that you see, or that you know of, what percentage are settled peacefully and the other, what percentage would go to court and be a long, drawn-out battle?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say absolutely most of them settle without going to court. Definitely. Yep. It'll be a relatively small percentage that go to court. My guess, I don't know the exact figures, but my guess would be maybe 10 to 20% at the most and end up in court. And then of the ones that go to court, it'd be an even smaller percentage that go all the way to a judge making a decision. It'd be less than 1 in 10. Most cases that start in the court process do resolve at a very early stage, which is good news for people.
Which is good. Mm. All right, I've got to go. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for having us, Alan.
And we look forward to seeing somebody next month.
Sounds good.
Thanks very much.
Thank
Bye.
You.